talking to me?
Funny like I'm a clown, I use you.
Here's Johnny.
He's looking at you, kid.
We're on a mission from God.
Go ahead. Make my day.
I'm going to make him an offer again with you.
Good morning, and welcome to the We Are Movie Geeks podcast. I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Batts.
And today is May 2nd. The year is one-third over.
That's hard to believe that April just zipped right past.
I guess so.
And the exciting movies, summer blockbusters, just about ready to start.
Official this Friday, huh? The official start. Although now, we've had a couple of early birds. I think Jungle Book is almost a summer movie, that's for sure.
What's your favorite movie so far this year, Jim?
I think it would have to be Sing Street.
Sing Street. Okay, what's your favorite movie so far this year, Michelle?
Oh, no.
She wasn't prepared for this question.
Oh,
Well, while you're thinking, I will also mention Zootopia, Jungle Book, Eye in the Sky, or close runners-up.
I'd have to go with The Witch.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's great, too. That'd be in my top 10, or maybe top 5.
The Cloverfield?
I thought you said Midnight Special.
Thank you. I was just trying. It's Monday. I was drawing a blank.
Yeah, I'll prepare you next time.
No, this is fine.
Okay, good.
You ambush.
I know, but I should have been.
Well,
speaking
of Jungle Book, it did pretty well at the box office again this weekend. Did it not, Michelle?
It did.
I think it's going to be its last time at number one.
Yeah, that's safe to say.
Pretty much. But that's 3 weeks straight?
Exactly. Yeah. So here are the top 12 domestic weekend box office estimates, according to score.com. At number one is The Jungle Book. Disney's movie took in $42.4 million for a new total of $252 million. It's on its way to cross the $300 million mark domestically, joining the likes of Deadpool, Batman vs. Superman, Dawn of Justice, and Zootopia. Claiming the number two spot is The Huntsman, Winter's War, with $9.4 million in its second weekend. Universal's movie dropped 52%.
I was going to ask how big the drop was. I know it had to have been at least 50%. But still, I'm surprised it's at number two, considering there were three big new features.
Yeah, really.
So far, it's taken in $33.9 million, but the price tag, $115 million.
Oh, yeah, I was going to say, it's not under $33 million, that's for certain.
At number three is newcomer Keanu from Warner Brothers Pictures. That movie took in $9.3 million in 2,658 cinemas.
That's pretty mild, I guess. Yeah.
The film finds the stars of Comedy Central's Keel and Peele trying to rescue a kidnapped kitten.
Didn't look like it cost anything.
No, $15 million to produce. Yeah, okay. But the reviews were good.
Except our review here.
At number four is Mother's Day from Open Road. That brought in a paltry, and burn, $8.3 million at 3,000 locations.
Yeah. 3,000? Oh, my gosh.
Well, Gary Marshall's, was it Valentine's Day, made $56 million.
I was just going to say, I
can't believe this only made $8
million. Yeah. 56 in its opening weekend?
Yeah.
Valentine's Day, it did. Oh. And Variety's reporting exclusively that Julia Roberts earned $3 million for Mother's Day for a supporting role that cost her 4 days to shoot.
I thought she was just doing it as a favor to Gary for Pretty Woman. Actually,
$3 million is a favor.
She should be fined $3 million for wearing that hideous red wig throughout the film.
We'll get into that later.
Well, you notice, though, in the poster, they've dyed that color of that wig sort of a light brown.
Right.
Oh, I didn't realize that. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Okay. But it's like carrot orange in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
Although, I'm really looking forward to her and George Clooney's movie, The Monster.
Money Monster.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yes.
At number five is Barbershop, The Next Cut from Warner Brothers Pictures. That movie took in another $6 million. This will be the lowest grossing part of the franchise, however, with a total of $44 million.
But it's hanging pretty tight in the top five, so I'm surprised it's still up there. Yeah,
I am too. At number six is Zootopia. That monster of a movie brought in $5 million. And at number seven, and officially DOA, is Ratchet and Clank.
Clank.
Focus Features pictures showed in 2,800 theaters and brought in only $4.8 million.
Jim will be reviewing Ratchet and Clank here in a few minutes.
No, I didn't get to see it. I endured that trailer, and that was enough. Yeah, well, they wouldn't show it to us, of course.
Of course. Universal Pictures' The Boss was number 8 with 4.2 million, followed by Batman vs. Superman: Dawn of Justice at number 9 with 3.8 million. The Kevin Costner movie Criminal was number 10 with 1.3 million, so it's still doing pretty well.
Yeah, it's surprising. It's still in the top 10,
At number 11 is My Big Fat Greek Wedding, number 2 from Universal Pictures with 1.1 million. And rounding out the 12 is Fathom Events Met Opera Electra 2016 with 1 million. Those do really well. People like to see them.
Well, I wonder if they opened Sing Street wide this weekend because it was only in one theater here in St. Louis.
That's still a slow rollout.
It's still, it's maybe, what do you think, about 30 theaters across the country, 50? Yeah. Or something.
And good word of mouth will help that movie.
Yeah, I hope it expands.
Well, good word of mouth did not help Everybody Wants Some. I kind of thought that would be something of a breakout because that got superb reviews, and it was a great movie, but then nobody's
I don't know. Maybe
that.
Maybe some of the audiences think they've seen it before. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they think it looks too close to Dazed and Confused. But Dazed and Confused is a great movie, so I don't know.
That might get a cult following just like
Did you know? I think Mother's Day will probably have a pretty strong second weekend because it's Mother's Day for
it's
one
Mother's
thing.
Day.
And there's going to be people looking to see something besides Civil War.
So on that note, opening May 6th, the only thing opening May 6th is Captain America Civil War. Yeah. ComScore's senior media analyst Paul Darabedian commented, ahead of its North American debut later this week, Disney's latest Marvel release, the massively entertaining Captain America Civil War, launched internationally this week into a phenomenal $200.2 million, setting multiple records that include all-time industry opening weekends in Brazil, Mexico, and the Philippines.
Oh, that's
so it's already had a $200 million.
That's pretty impressive. That's pretty much its budget there. I imagine it's a $200 million movie. But, of course,
the reviews are stellar.
Yeah, I was surprised how many are on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's like about 80 reviews are already on Rotten Tomatoes.
Have you read them all?
No, I'm not going to look at any of them.
And one other thing, notably, China-based title Finding Mr. Right 2 had a stellar $51 million debut in just 4 territories. So that's it for the box office this weekend. Can't wait to see what Captain America does for the 3-day.
Well,
coming up.
Yeah, I'm just looking forward to the film itself. They're going to show it to the press tomorrow night.
Is it in 3D?
I think so.
Galaxy.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I know when the Galaxy had a press screening of Ant-Man, it was not in 3D.
So I wanted
to see that in 3D a couple of days later. Yes. And that was highly entertaining, and I'm really looking forward to it. So this will be the official start of the summer season, I guess. They're gearing up. I'm sure they're getting more people staffed at the theaters for it, and I imagine it'll be tough.
It's going to have a huge weekend.
Well, it's going to be in so many theaters. Shouldn't have a problem seeing it. It's just going to be the theaters are going to be so crowded, and the parking lots and everything. So be interesting.
All right, well, let's get started on reviewing some movies. Like I say, I think Mother's Day will probably do pretty well. Because this Sunday, a lot of women in their 20s and 30s and 40s are going to take their mothers who are in their 50s and 60s to see Mother's Day. And it's not a very good movie. I gave it 1.5 stars. Yeah, but it's not so bad that it's going to ruin their outing.
The director of Pretty Woman and Valentine's Day.
Sandy's ex just got remarried to like a 12-year-old.
Tweet at me if you want to check in.
Did she just say tweet at me?
Invites you to celebrate the most important job in the world.
Yellow card. Are you...
Oh, he blew another man's whistle. Baby, you better go. You go get hurt.
Well, they deserve a better movie than that. Take their moms, too. Take them to see Sing Street.
That's
a fun outing.
Yeah.
This is dreadful.
I reviewed Mother's Day at WeAreMovieGeeks.com, and I gave it 1.5 out of 5 stars.
A generous man.
It's not a very good movie. Jennifer Aniston stars, and
she's got the biggest role of the four in it, doesn't she?
Yeah, she plays the mother of two sons whose ex-husband, played by Timothy Olyphant, is married a woman who's still in her 20s, who's trying sort of to be the cool stepmom to these two boys, and Jennifer's kind of having to deal with that. And then you've got these two sisters played by Kate Hudson and who's the other guy?
Oh, Clark, I think. She played Becky on Roseanne, I think.
Really?
It's Sarah Clark, I think, is her name. Yeah, I'm not 100% sure.
Doesn't sound right.
Yeah, Sarah Clark is an actress from St. Louis, as I'm confusing her, but it is. We'll have to look that up. But
Michelle, look that up, would you please?
thanks.
Anyways, they play two sisters who live next door to each other, and they're hiding their respective mates from their narrow-minded parents because Kate Hudson is married to a Mideastern dude. Even though he's a doctor, you'd think they'd be happy that their daughter married a doctor, but no, he's from, I don't know where he's from.
He's from India or Pakistan. Yeah. Asif Manvi plays him from Comedy Central.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, from The Daily Show.
Well, he's about the palest Mideastern dude. I'm darker than that guy.
Yeah, he was the pizza owner that fires Peter Parker at the start of Spider-Man 2. Right? Yes.
And then her sister is married to another woman. Oh, my gosh. So they're narrow-minded parents, played by Robert Pine and Margot Martindale,
who just stepped out of a 70s sitcom.
Yeah, apparently they haven't seen him in a few years.
Oh, Sarah Chalk. I was mispronouncing.
And she's from Canada.
Yes, she was on Scrubs, and like I say, she was right? Becky Two on Roseanne.
She was.
Oh, okay. Really?
I'm sorry. Yes. So,
and then there's Julia Roberts, who plays this home shopping network superstar, but it takes place in Atlanta. But she's just visiting Atlanta, right?
Yeah. Okay. They're doing remotes from Atlanta, but it reminded me of the much better movie Joy, except Joy Mangano was selling things that were useful. I mean, Julia's character is saying, the mood bracelets.
Yeah, that's right.
Mood pendants.
Yeah,
and it's like this useless tchotchkes.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's what they selling that thing though,
but
that's
well, mop, more... you can mop the floor. It's good.
and then she's childless, but of course she's not really childless because we meet this other character who you know is going to turn out to be her long lost daughter, like the moment you meet her. And then that character has a boyfriend, a British boyfriend, who's a bartender who wants to be a stand up comic, but she has commitment issues and doesn't want to marry this guy, even though she's had his baby.
Yeah, this character, this woman that you're talking about, is played by Kimmy Robertson, she's a talented young actress, but boy, she's just picked the lousiest projects the last couple of years.
Was she in
top worst list twice last year. For the Longest Ride, another Nicholas Sparks disaster, and Tomorrowland.
Was she the main girl in Tomorrowland?
She was.
Really?
She was, yeah. And I was like, I hope she can get better scripts.
Well, she's 24 years old. I thought that girl was a little younger, but I wasn't paying that much attention, I guess.
She's a good actress, you know?
Yeah. But anyways, this movie, Mother's Day, it's not very good. It's really schmaltzy.
Oh, you
kind of ridiculous.
The schmaltziest subplot may be involving Jason Sudeikis' character.
This is such pandering.
It made me angry watching it.
Yeah,
he's
widowed, and his wife, who's played by Jennifer Garner in this kind of weird little cameo in this video that they're watching, and I guess they both had been in the Marines, and the daughters say, oh, my dad was a gunnery sergeant in the Marines. Well, this guy is like the twinkiest gunnery sergeant in the history of motion pictures. You're not told exactly how she died. I guess you assume she died in combat. I don't know.
Yeah. But I mean, you know, the fact that I think the first time we see Jason's character, maybe he and the daughter's at the graveside.
Yeah.
One of the earliest appearances of him. And it's just, come on, man. You know, you're just trying to pummel our heartstrings.
Yeah. And then he meets Jennifer Aniston, and he's in the grocery store, and I put this in my review, and he's buying tampons for his little girl. And of course you get the scene where the checkout girl grabs the microphone over the PA and says, I need a price check on these tampons. So he jumps and he grabs the microphone. He goes, no, it's okay. Which I said in my review, Michael Keaton did that exact gag in Mr. Mom in 1983. But now these are like...
It's not aged well like good wine.
No. But, of course, these are eco-friendly cotton tampons. So I guess it has that.
Now, that was when I was in the concession stand getting a refill of popcorn. So I wish I had seen that so I could have groaned.
It was awful. And then Jennifer Aniston's behind him in line. So they have a little meet cute there. And then she's out in her car throwing a tantrum. Because I guess, is that when she gets the news that her ex has married this younger woman? And she's sitting in her car screaming. And that's how they meet. But then they don't really... You expect them to have a couple more scenes throughout the film, and they really don't until near the very end when they're both in the hospital for some reason.
Yeah, all these stories get connected because Aniston is a designer, and she's designed some set for this new TV, you know, shopping show that Julia Roberts' character, you know, is going to put together. But, oh, it's awful. And Jason Sudeikis at the health club. He owns a health club now.
Yeah.
And he's got three sassy women who are friends.
He's in everything lately, though. Think about it.
Well, he was. We saw him in Race earlier this year. Mm-hmm. He was much better in that, that's for certain.
I didn't see that, but he's as bland as they come.
But Lonnie Love plays his sassy, black friend.
And she seems like an afterthought. It's like the screenwriters all of a sudden realized they didn't have any black characters in this movie, so they did throw one in there. So, of course, it was this loudmouth, sassy best friend of this guy.
And of course, we have a Latino character played by Hector Elizondo, who will always have a job as long as Gary Marshall is making films.
80 years old, Mr. Elizondo. And Gary Marshall's 81. Why don't these guys hang it up?
Well, you know, there is something to be said for resting on your laurels.
I guess. But then you mentioned Margot Martindale and Robert Pine. And actually, in my opinion, they were the most entertaining characters in the whole movie. They didn't really seem to fit in. They were so broad.
Yeah, they're like from another movie, from another time period, another Earth or something.
Yeah, but it was kind of funny. I thought they were kind of funny, actually.
I mean, he's chomping on a chicken bone.
Yeah,
when
that's
first
how he's introduced. And then they're in this giant RV parked in front of their daughter's home,
like Cousin Eddie.
Yeah. Exactly. But the lesbian daughter and her partner have made this parade float that's a giant birth canal.
Oh, God.
And it was supposed to be, what, for a Mother's Day parade?
Every town has a Mother's Day parade. Tom, where you been? What the hell?
And do gay men make a float that's a giant penis?
For
Father's Day? Maybe in San Francisco.
It sounds funnier than it plays, but it's just so ludicrous.
And then there's like this chase through the suburb of Atlanta with this big giant birth canal float and this RV that Robert Pine is pretending like the brakes are out on, but they're not really. He's just pulling your leg there.
Yeah, the brakes are out.
And that's Chris Pine's dad.
That's right.
And I was telling Tom, I think he's the son of Evelyn Anchors.
Oh, I looked it up. No, it wasn't Evelyn Anchors.
Is it Anne Gwynn?
Yes, and he's the son-in-law. His wife was the daughter of Anne Gwynn.
It's an interesting lineage. More interesting than this film, that's for sure.
Yeah. You got this whole subplot with this wedding and Julia Roberts' long-lost daughter and... That is really the most nauseating part. And then she's just visiting Atlanta, but she has this scrapbook of pictures of the daughter that she'd given up for adoption many years earlier. It's this huge scrapbook. What does she carry this with
just
her wherever
travels?
She goes from city to city? Oh, I just happen to have this scrapbook with pictures of you. I knew it was you the moment I saw you.
But, God. But we mentioned about, I think when we came out of the theater, I said, what was the deal with that orange Louise Brooks hairstyle that they've got? I don't like to criticize appearances, but this was a choice they made. It's just obviously wearing a wig or something, and it's like they could have gotten some hairstyle that was more businesswoman like or more flattering. But it's just distracting.
It was a character of its own. Her hair. Oh. Better give you something else to make fun of. Again, though,
there's plenty.
Again, though, there's a lot of women. They're gonna end up enjoying this film. Two women that we saw it with were laughing and crying, and it pushes a lot of buttons, and some people are going to fall for this. It's not really a movie for me to sit there and criticize, even though that's what I do.
But I shouldn't say just for there are a lot of undiscerning fellas that will probably get into this too, and some guys might enjoy it just for the camp aspects of it.
It's so lousy
it's almost campy. But it's just excruciating to sit through.
It is. All right, so Jim and I do not recommend Mother's Day. Another movie we saw last week was Keanu.
Let's just go check it out.
What's the worst that can happen?
One beer, please.
I'll take a white wine spritz.
Clarence.
What?
You can't talk like that.
You sound like John Ritter all the time.
You in the right place?
Yeah, we're in the right place.
I'm Tectonic.
Nice. My name is Shark Tank.
Oh.
Keanu stars, I don't know these guys' names, Peel and Keel or something?
Yeah, Jordan Peel and Keegan-Michael Key.
But God love them. They've been all over the place. They've been on
promoting.
ESPN. Every place.
They are selling this
movie.
Yeah. Right. It's a movie about these guys looking for their cat that is kidnapped by a bunch of gangsters. And that's about it. It has about the slightest plot I've ever seen a movie hang its story on, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's mainly for fans of their TV show on Comedy Central, which just wrapped up its run, I guess, a few months ago. I know that they had the two guys that are their buddies in it. Say Jordan Peele is the one that's just getting over a breakup with his girlfriend. Keegan-Michael Key is the fellow that is kind of nerdy and a married guy and all, and his wife is gone for the weekend with their daughter, and the two of them are getting together. He's trying to cheer up his buddy, so they go to the movies, and of course they see a movie with Liam Neeson, and of course in the car after, so he loves more Liam Neeson's.
Yeah, and the movie was called The Substitute Teacher. Which I think is a sketch that they do.
Yeah, well, they do a sketch with these two valets that are just screaming at each other about how much they love Liam Neeson's.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, does it translate? If you don't know the TV show, does it?
Not really.
Well, I think some of it Jim does. Some of it's pretty funny.
I think there was a good 10 or 12 laughs in the movie, which is pretty good, but spread over 100 minutes, there was a lot of time between the laughs.
Well, it's the same problem most comedies have. They're just too darn long these days. Most comedy should be over 90 minutes. This shouldn't have been. This should have been 95 at the top.
Well, it was only 100, so it didn't go that far over. Well, I'm not sure that was the problem. It wasn't like one of these Apatow comedies that goes over 2 hours.
Yeah,
sometime.
I just
think it was all that funny. And I guess if you're a fan of these two guys, you've already got something invested in them. And which one was the tall guy, the bald guy?
Keegan-Michael Key is the tall, bald fellow.
I'll give you, he's got a good delivery. He's got some charisma. His shorter friend,
That's Peele.
Oh, that's Peele. Okay, Peele. I don't get him. I don't think that guy has much charisma, or it was very funny at all. And Key, I think I saw him in Pitch Perfect 2 last year. I thought he really stood out in that.
One of the bright spots of Tomorrowland, also.
Yeah. So he's pretty good, but this movie wasn't really very funny. I didn't think.
I thought it seemed kind of tiresome. Yeah, well, it has that 45 or 40 minute lull. It seems like most comedies, when they hit that point, it starts to get really slow and uninteresting, and then they try to perk it up a little bit at the end by bringing in Luis Guzman as some big drug kingpin. Yeah. But by that time, you're kind of wore out.
I think it hit the 45-minute lull at about the 15-minute point. But but then there's it missed out some opportunities. There's this whole running gag, which is actually pretty funny, where the guy he's black, but he's a big fan of George Michael, and the whole thing with him being sort of having these white interests was a running gag, and that was kind of funny. But why didn't they bring in George Michael? That would have been a perfect opportunity. They had this fantasy scene where he kind of conks out on some drug and he wakes up in a dream, but he's in the George Michael video.
Yeah, that kind of doesn't pay off at all, really.
No,
would
a George Michael have something better to do?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess maybe they thought he was. Maybe he thought they were making fun of him. But,
yeah, maybe.
But I think they were making fun of the fact that these hardcore gangsters were into him, and somehow that these guys were bluffing their way through it. And I have a little more affection for it because I like the idea of a comedy team of two actors that are specifically linked together, as opposed to, say, Seth Rogen and James Franco that just kind of act in films together but have really separate careers. Mm-hmm. And these guys are pretty linked together, like, Laurel and Hardy or Abbott and Costello or something like that.
But they're no Abbott and Costello.
Well, no.
At least so
no.
far. Maybe their next movie would be better. I'm not going to.
Yeah, they're not even Wheeler and Woozy.
This was just one long skit.
A lot of films are. Yeah, they would be better 20-minute skits. Or this would have been a nice episode of their show.
Yeah, but another poor choice by Warner Brothers, last year's.
All right. Keanu has a few intermittent laughs, but on balance, I don't recommend it. What would you have given it, Jim? I would have probably given it 2 out of 5.
Maybe 3. Okay.
Jim liked it a little bit better than me.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on. Jim saw Papa Hemingway.
Oh, brother. This was a long slog.
Papa Hemingway in Cuba.
Yes, in Cuba.
Oh, okay. Hemingway in Cuba is the complete title.
It's supposedly based on a true story of this Miami Globe reporter who's played by Giovanni Ribisi. He's called Ed Myers in the film, but he's actually a fellow named Denny Petit Clerc, who befriended Hemingway in the late 50s when he was down in Cuba. It sets it up that this guy is an orphan, and that reading Hemingway's stories, Ernest became sort of a surrogate father to him, and Hemingway gets a fan letter and invites him to visit him on the island, where, let's see, he's played by a stage actor named Adrian Sparks, plays Ernest Hemingway. Oh, yeah. And you might recognize him. He was in the Purge, Anarchy, and Insidious 3, but mostly known for his TV work, although I guess he's played Hemingway on stage a few times.
And from what I saw from the clips, and we have a contest running for it right now, a national contest, it was an interesting choice I think of casting. Do you think maybe they could have gone with somebody bigger, or was it good that they left it more?
Probably that they left it to a pretty much unknown, so okay. that you're not thinking of him as this other actor. You're more thinking of him as
exactly,
Hemingway
as
in
Hemingway.
It.
Good
now, a familiar face plays his wife, Marion, and that's Julie Richardson.
Exactly. See, that's what yeah. I'm saying. All these well-known...
And, yeah, and James Remar plays this this gangster down in Cuba, but the script is so ham-headed, they kept on referring to him as a mafia. You know he's in the mafia. Yeah, this guy is what they keep saying like five or six times. Like, we get yeah. it. We know. Come on.
That's what Kate Markey, who reviewed it for us, yeah. that was her issue, you yeah. know, in her review with the movie.
But she is right that the Cuban locations are gorgeous. Yeah. The period look of it is pretty nice. It's just so dull. And, you know, the revolution is going on in Cuba. And aside from, you know, it's one of the guys getting marked for death by the police. And you know, there's reuse of this footage that they shot of some sort of raid on a building. And they keep referring to it. And they have lots of headlines. It's a wonder they didn't have the spinning newspapers from the old movies about, you know, Castro, you know, taking over Cuba and this and that. And Minka Kelly is kind of wasted as Giovanni Ribisi's girlfriend and who inspires him to go out to Cuba, but never goes there herself. And I think Kate mentioned that she was sort of similar to Grace Kelly in Rear Window, but not nearly as interesting as she is in Rear Window. Mm-hmm. And it just kind of slogs along. And you're watching, you know, Hemingway get drunk all the time and teasing about him, you know, taking a gun to his head, mm-hmm. even though you know the facts of it and that's going to happen eventually. But
does it happen in the film?
No, it doesn't. Oh, okay. Actually, it happened in Idaho a couple of years after he left Cuba. But what's interesting is they have a big dinner party, and I'm watching it, and there's a woman with dark jet black hair and glasses, and that's Mariel Hemingway. So
yes.
she got herself into this
yes,
film.
She
yeah,
did.
Yeah,
huh.
yeah. So I guess she was kind of overseeing it. It was actually shot at Hemingway's house, mm-hmm. which is a museum, I guess, now mm-hmm. in Cuba. But the locations are nice, but it just slogs along. And it's directed by a fellow named Bob Yari, who's mostly known as producer. He was one of the producers, controversial producers on Crash a few years ago.
Yes, mm-hmm. he was.
And this is the second film he's directed. He directed a thriller called Mind Games in 1989, and the pacing in this is just all off, and it's just kind of meanders, and you're watching Julie Richardson's character Mary fighting with Ernest Hemingway through all of it, and way too many shots of Ernest and her skinny dipping in the pool, and it's just kind of monotonous.
All right.
And at least Ribisi's not doing that gravelly voice he's been doing for the last two or three movies. Yeah. So I was pleased about that, at least.
All right. So Jim thinks Papa Hemingway in Cuba is a bit of a snooze. All right, let's move along then. The other movie we're going to review. Oh, we're down to our last movie.
Yes. That's not a snooze.
No, it's not a snooze. It's called Green Room, and it is directed by Jeremy Saulnier, and this is sort of his follow-up to Blue Ruin. Which was made a couple of years ago, which kind of put him on the map. Blue Ruin is a good film. It's better than this Green Room.
Gentlemen, you're trapped. Things have gone south. It won't end well.
You can't keep us here, man. You gotta let us go.
We're not keeping you. We're just staying.
Shoot who's left.
Let him bleed.
Well, this Green Room is pretty good. It's about this thrasher metal band, I guess you would call them, named the Anchorites. And they're on the road in their van, and were they up in Oregon, I believe?
Yes, I believe that's where they end up.
And somehow they end up in this backwoods bar, and it's populated by just what seems like an army of skinheads who are dancing and scowling at their music as they play, and they're in the green room, which is, I guess, is the waiting room where the bands hang out while they're waiting for their set. And one of the band members, after their set, has left her cell phone in the green room. So she walks into the green room, and guess what? They've stabbed to death another young woman, and she's laying on the floor dead. So, hey, we're trying to record a podcast in here. Anyway.
Oh, they're doing their Tennessee Williams thing, yeah. Yes, yes.
Okay. I'm sure this microphone picked that up.
Yes.
What was they talking about? See what happens?
Green room.
So the band is sort of held captive in this green room. There's like five members of this band. One's a woman.
Yeah, that's Ali Shawat, who you might remember from Arrested Development.
No, I don't remember her from Arrested Development. And then there's another woman in the green room, played by Imogen Poots, who is a good friend of this woman who has just been murdered. So the whole movie is basically something of a sort of a siege film or hostage drama with this band's in this green room, and the owner of the bar is played by Captain Picard himself.
Yes, Jean-Luc, and not sounding much different than Picard, you know.
No.
It's weird. He's overseeing this bar where all these really nasty skinheads are, but he's a very erudite fellow.
Yeah,
you know.
So the skinheads call him in because we got a problem. So he shows up and basically he says, just go kill them all. You know, this movie is. I will give Jeremy Saulnier a lot of credit for generating a lot of tension and a lot of suspense, but boy, this is one unpleasant, ugly movie.
Oh, yes, yes.
I mean, you've got box cutter slicings. Oh. You've got dogs ripping the throats out of people.
Does Patrick Stewart look like he's having a good time?
Not really.
No. He's pretty dour.
You've got a scene where this girl has this knife embedded in her head, and she's being dragged across the floor by the handle of the knife. And then, Patrick Stewart, I don't really understand. First of all, he's not given a whole lot to do. He's not given any memorable lines. I keep reading his reviews to say how spellbinding he is, and he's fine. But you never, who is this guy? Why are these guys taking orders from him? Why is he so evil?
That was one of the complaints from one of the critics at the screening I went to, is that there's, what is going on there? There's no backstory.
No.
And I think that maybe the director is wanting an immediacy to it, that he wants to plunge you right into this sort of unfamiliar setting so that you're more like the group, like the band that's led by Anton Yelchin, who's kind of having a reunion with Imogen Poots since they co-starred in Fright Night a couple of years ago. But this is not as good as Fright Night, I don't believe.
No, nor as good as Blue Ruin. And in Yelchin, there's a scene where his hand gets almost cut off. It's hanging by the end of his arm by a couple of tendons. And yet, 15 minutes later, he's fighting some other people, in another part of the bar. And they keep going back to the green room. They get out of the green room and they sneak down to the basement and they sneak up into the attic and they sneak here and there, and then they keep ending up back in the green room because they can't get out of this building for some reason. And it just gets kind of redundant and it just goes on and on.
But it's only about 90 minutes, they could have really, hammered it in. But the brevity is good with this film.
Yeah, I guess. I had high expectations for this film, and I had heard such great things. Michael Hafner had raved about it earlier. And
Anton Yelchin's arm is saved by the miracle of duct tape.
Oh, that's right. They duct tape his arm. And then they take the markers and they put like war paint on their faces with these black Sharpies, which just seem sort of pointless.
Well, without giving away too much, I'm wondering, Tom, are you surprised at how quickly some of the band members got taken out?
Yeah.
And I was like, this is kind of real, In most movies, they would be kind of together through most of it. And it's like the first attempt, boom, there's blood spilled.
Yeah,
you know?
No doubt. Like I said, it has some tension and
was this also
suspense,
video on demand, like day and date release type thing, or was this just a theatrical?
I thought it was just a theatrical.
Theatrical for now. But this is off the subject. But that movie High Rise with Thomas Hiddleston is on demand now.
Yes.
And I thought I was kind of waiting for that to come out to theaters.
Yeah, no, I think that was, it was one of those.
Yeah. All right. So Green Room, it's an okay movie. I'd probably give it 2.5, maybe 3 out of 5. On the other hand, I was expecting it to be a lot better. What do you think, Jim? What would you give it?
Yeah, well, it's it is nasty. It had me squirming in my seat several times, and I'm pretty hardened, I thought, to that stuff. But I give it maybe 3, 3.25,
All right. We sort of recommend Green Room.
Yeah. You know what you're getting into.
Yeah. All right. What else can we talk about? Michelle Thompson's going to call us here in a few minutes. That's pretty exciting. Melissa Thompson, I'm sorry. Sure, it's always fun when Melissa calls in. Let's talk about a couple of local things real quick. Tomorrow night is my 16mm double feature night. I am showing a 16mm print of The Poseidon Adventure starting at 8 o'clock. And after that, I will be showing my 16mm print of Jason and the Argonauts. I think I talked about that a couple weeks ago, that the third reel had some water damage. I actually ran it through my projector. It's not as bad as I remember it. So I'm not going to cut out the section with the water damage. I'm just going to show it as is. It kind of comes and goes. And by the time the skeletons show up to battle Jason and his men, the film's totally cleared up. So that'll be good. And that is at the Way Out Club starting at 8 o'clock. It is free, but we set out a jar for the National Children's Cancer Society. Now I can announce what I am showing next week. I mean, next month, rather, at my 16mm double feature night. That will be Tuesday, June 7th. I'm going to start out with a 16mm print of Mel Brooks' classic 1974 comedy, Young Frankenstein. Starring, of course, Gene Wilder and Peter Boyle. And who
would
else
you like to
there?
Have a role in the hay?
Marty Feldman and Gene Hackman. Who else is in there? Madeline Kahn. It's a classic.
Kenneth Mars.
Yeah. And
actually, it's the Hermit.
We showed a Rogers print of Young Frankenstein at the Way Out Club about 3 years ago when I did Super 8 Children's Cancer Fundraiser Movie Madness, and his print looks fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
So that'll be June 7th. We'll show that first. Then we're going to follow that up with a print of a gangster movie that I have a soft spot for. It's 1975's Capone. Ever seen Capone, Jim?
I don't think I've seen it all the way through. Yeah. Is that the one with Ben Gazzara?
Yeah, Ben Gazzara is Al Capone, and
Stallone?
Stallone is Frank Nitti, yeah.
Ah.
It's really good. I have a soft spot in my heart because when I was like 13, 15 years old, I was so obsessed with seeing R-rated movies, I would ride my bike up to the DePere 4, I think it's now the 14, but back then it was the DePere 4 Theater, and I would ask strange men in the parking lot to buy my tickets for R-rated movies, and Capone is one of the films I got to see under those circumstances, so I've always really liked this film.
It's not the one with Susan Blakely,
yes,
is it?
Yes, it's okay. One with Susan Blakely, exactly, and you know, John Cassavetes and Harry Gardino are in it.
Nice cast.
Yeah, it was directed by Steve Carver, who did a lot of interesting films for Roger Corman in the 70s, including Drum with Pam Grier and A Big Bad Mama with Angie Dickinson and The Arena also with Pam Grier. So it's very violent and it's full of gore and nudity, and it's a really good R-rated gangster movie from 1975. So I'll be showing a 16mm print of that along with Young Frankenstein on June 7th at the Way Out Club. Let's see, what else can we talk about? You know, this is kind of a remarkable week in St. Louis because you could actually go see Blue Velvet, Taxi Driver, and Blade Runner on the big screen this week.
Wow.
If you wanted to. Blue Velvet is celebrating its 30th anniversary with a screening at the Moolah. And, I mean, just a regular screening. That's what's showing at the Moolah now. They're going to show Civil War, I think, starting Thursday. So
You
only have a couple more nights to see it. But Blue Velvet's a movie I haven't seen on the big screen since it was new. It's a great movie. I saw it a couple times when it first came out in 1986.
Certainly worth seeing on the big screen. Yeah, definitely.
And it's, you know, David Lynch's masterpiece. And it's really, I think, the movie that sort of led into his cult TV show Twin Peaks. And it's about, you know, disease under the bucolic surface of a small town. And it's just great. Isabella Rossellini is amazing, but especially Dennis Hopper's Frank Booth.
That's so
great film. And then of Taxi Driver, of course, is celebrating its 40th anniversary. And it is running at the High Point. And I guess they're going to probably start Civil Wars there Thursday night as well. So you have a couple of nights to see Taxi Driver on the big screen.
Yeah. I had a couple of guys at the dormitory where I went to college. Every weekend, they would search out some theater in Chicago that was running Taxi Driver, usually a second or third part of a triple bill or double bill, and they would try to see it every weekend.
That's the movie I've seen at the big screen more than any other movie. I was completely obsessed with Taxi Driver when I was a teenager. I had a green army jacket like Travis Bickle, and I would wear it to school, and I would draw pictures of Travis Bickle all over my notebooks. I was kind of a weird kid. And I wrote love letters to Jodie Foster. And then this Friday and Saturday.
Just never pressed her enough, did you?
That's right. And then this Friday and Saturday night at Tivoli, as part of the Real Late at the Tivoli Midnight series, is Ridley Scott's Blade Runner from 1982, starring Harrison Ford and Rutger Hauer and all kinds of good actors.
Yeah.
This is, I think they call it the final cut. Which I guess is, I guess the final cut, what is, without the narration? Is that how it works?
I think so. Yeah, Daryl Hannah, Sean Young.
Yeah. But you know, I always liked the narration. Mm-hmm. I thought the narration was kind of cool in Blade Runner. I wish they hadn't removed it. And it's also got a couple of scenes that are sort of insinuate that Deckard himself is a replicant and that weren't in the original version.
Yeah. And I think the plans are going ahead for the sequel, right?
Yeah, they've been talking about this sequel for a long time, though. So I don't know. I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah.
So that's what's going on locally. Also this Thursday over at Schlafly Bottleworks, I host a film series. And they're showing a documentary called America's Blues. It's about blues musicians. And the director, whose name is Patrick Branson, will be there. And he'll do a Q&A, and that is this Thursday night, May 5th, at Schlafly Bottle Works over there in Maplewood. And that is a fundraiser for Helping Kids Together. And that's, I think, $5. So go check that out as well. I'll be back in time.
This past week, there were various events going on in Hollywood. Tinseltown show, the TCM Film Festival. Also, the Universal Park had the debut of Harry Potter's Wizarding World, their theme park open. And the DeLorean car from Back to the Future has a new home at the Peterson Automotive Museum. Here to talk about all these fine Tinseltown events is our own Melissa Thompson out in California. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, guys.
Hi, Melissa.
How are you guys? How you doing?
Good morning.
Good. How you doing? How's everything?
Good, good.
Great.
So what one do you want to talk about first?
Well, last week, it was sort of a dream come true of mine. I went to the L.A.'s famed Peterson Automotive Museum because that is now the new home, the permanent home, for the famous DeLorean time machine from Back to the Future. Now, Back to the Future easily fits into one of my top three movies of all time. So I was beyond thrilled to go and take a look at that.
Did you get to sit in it?
No, but we got pretty close. I was standing right next to it. Like, we could take pictures of inside of the famous flux capacitor. And they've done an amazing restoration on this car. They had a panel discussion with Bob Gale, who wrote the movie.
From St. Louis.
Yeah.
And he's from St. Louis.
And then there was also the guy from the restoration group that did the car. And basically this car was restored by fans, really. Because what happened was, after the movie finished, it was, you know, there were seven cars originally purchased as picture cars for this film. And the main car, which they call the hero car, which was the one in every sequence that Michael J. Fox is driving it, and it rolls off the back of Doc Brown's truck. That's the car that we're talking about. And it was sitting on the back lot at Universal. First, they had it out front as a display when they did the ride, the attraction at Universal, Back to the Future. But fans got, you know, it was roped off, but fans would get a little close. They'd want to lean against it and take pictures, and it got scratched. And sitting outside in the weather and the elements, it really was in sad shape. And these guys that were just huge fans and car geeks, they saw it, and they had this idea to contact the people involved with the movie, Bob Gale and Universal. And they just ran with it. And then they had another friend of theirs who decided to film a documentary documenting this whole process of restoring the car. It's called Out of Time, and it comes out next month. They have a website and DVD, and they really did a great job on this car. And you just walk up to it, and you feel like you're. And it's got sound effects. The car, the original picture car for the movie, never had sound. Later on in post, they added the iconic sound of the steam when the gull wing doors open, or when the flux capacitor is on. That stuff they added later. But the car itself never had those noises. With this restoration, however, they added all that. They hit speakers inside, and they really did a wonderful job of restoring this car. So it's now in its permanent home in Los Angeles at the Peterson Auto Museum. They had the unveiling with the panel discussion. And then they also, just for the fun of it, a couple nights later, they recreated the famous Enchantment Under the Sea dance from the movie. And they had a couple of 80s bands playing, and it was a lot of fun. So that was a good event to go to. And like I said, anybody who's a fan of that car or that movie, it's really something to be standing right next to it, the actual car with every single solitary original part from the movie.
So, and that is the permanent home. It's not just a temporary exhibit.
No, they decided that was the agreement they made with the Peterson. They really, because had it not been at the Peterson, it would be in storage somewhere at Universal Studios, who owned the car. And I just picture this big warehouse, like from Raiders of the Lost Ark at the end, where you just walk in and there's 100,000 crates. And that's what would have happened to this car had these guys, these super fans, had they not, you know, pursued this whole project. So it's really great. If anyone's ever out here and you get to the Peterson, go check it out because it's really, really amazing. And speaking of Universal, also this last week, or the week before, I guess, was the grand opening of the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. And that Universal Orlando already has that at that theme park, so they wanted to bring it to Southern California. So about a week or two ago, they opened it here, and we went and checked that out on Friday. And
Universal invited us.
Universal. And it's really actually pretty cool. If you're a real diehard Harry Potter fan, you'll love it. Walk in and you really think you're in that whole world with the big buildings and the snow covered and the owls and the little alleys where you can go and buy your wand and your robe and all the stuff you need to go to Hogwarts.
Can you play Quidditch?
You know what? You do, actually. And it's pretty freaking amazing. On the one ride they have, you're sitting in these seats. Like, you get in like a roller coaster, and the bar comes down over you, and you're sitting there, but your legs are dangling. You're not touching the floor or anything.
Yeah. Oh,
so
cool.
Off you go, and then you put on the 3D glasses, and then off you go into the Wizarding World of Harry Potter, and it's pretty amazing. You're flying around above Hogwarts and above the train station, and then as you get to Hogwarts, and then you get to play in a Quidditch game.
Wow.
And you really think you're playing. It's really, really awesome. It's really cool, and it's crowded now as usual, so you know the lines are really, really long, but it's so worth it because it's a lot of fun.
So was it built on special with Universal Theme Park?
Yeah, you know, it's this weird collaboration because, you know, Harry Potter's
Warner Brothers.
Yeah, it's not really part of their whole franchises and stuff like that they would have there, but they did a really good job of, you know, they needed to have something there that was a little more current. They got rid of a lot of old attractions. Like I said, they used to have a Back to the Future attraction that's no longer there. They used to have a Terminator attraction that's no longer there. So, you know, they just keep kind of moving things around. But this is a permanent, I mean, they've really gone all out for this Harry Potter thing. You know, guests can taste butterbeer and they can eat this great food that they have at the restaurants in there. And you can go to, I'm not that big a Harry Potter fan. What's the name of that? Something Alley?
Diagon Alley? Diagon Alley.
Okay. Okay, well, they have that recreated, so it's really, really special. You go in there, and you're treated not like a guest at a theme park, but like somebody really there. So they fit you for your wand and for your robe, and it's really cool. I think families will love it. Kids that love Harry Potter, even adults that love Harry Potter, because it's been around for so long now, definitely worth checking out.
But do they still have the Water World attraction at the Universal?
They do, and you know that's always a good one because after you've been walking around all day,
that's timely.
Where you can sit for a while,
because nobody's there.
Yeah, it's a good chance during the day at the park to go and sit. So it's a lot of fun. Yeah, they still have that.
And then what else did you cover? What was the last thing you covered over the weekend for us?
Oh, that was the Turner Classic Movie Film Festival, which is my absolute favorite. I love old movies. I love old musicals. I love all that stuff. So this was the eighth annual Turner Classic Movie Film Festival. They show it at a bunch of theaters around Hollywood. The Dolby Theater and the Hollywood and Highland Complex, where the Chinese Theater is, all those theaters are completely full up with showing the festival. And the El Capitan Theater across the street shows it, and the famous old Egyptian Theater in Hollywood down the block, they also show film festival movies. I went in Saturday for about a 16-hour shift.
Ah.
I started with 9 o'clock in the morning. I started with Field of Dreams, that great Kevin Costner movie,
mm-hmm.
the one that, you know, pretty much the only movie that makes grown men cry.
Mm-hmm. But did they show Waterworld, too?
No.
Okay.
Now, that makes studio executives cry.
That's not quite yet considered a classic, but it will be, I promise.
I agree.
So we started with Field of Dreams, which was great because that was shown on the Chinese theater's big IMAX screen. So that was great. And for 9 in the morning, to have to get there at about 8, it was a packed house, completely packed. Then after that, I went to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. That was presented at the theater with special guests Danny DeVito and Christopher Lloyd.
Neat.
And again, another weird tie into Back to the Future. But anyway. So they were there to talk about the film beforehand and their experiences filming it, and they had a lot of really cool stories. There was a real asylum where they filmed this place somewhere out in Minnesota or something, and it had been you know, shut down years before, so it was obviously empty, and that's where they found this great location to film the movie, aside from some other interiors that were shot on the soundstage in Hollywood. But most of it was filmed on location at this asylum. And Danny DeVito and Christopher Lloyd just talked about, you know, they're both very young in their careers, and they hadn't done a lot of stuff, so, you know, they weren't thinking anything of this movie. They just knew that they were hired to be in a Jack Nicholson movie, so they showed up. Another funny story, Will Sampson, who plays the chief, the big Native American
Chief Bromden
guy, he's fantastic in that movie, and that was his first film. Because when they were in this location in Minnesota, they figured, let's talk to some of the townspeople and see who they know. They talked to a car dealership guy, and they said, you know, he said, yeah, I talk to people all the time coming in to buy cars. And they said, well, because it's how it was written in the book, they're like, we need this really large Native American man. So if you know anybody, and lo and behold, 2 days later, Will Sampson walks in there to buy a used truck. And they ask him, have you ever acted before? And he says, nope. And he said, would you like to? And he said, sure, why not? And that's how he got into the movies. That was his first film. And he's so memorable in that movie. And it's such a wonderful film. So we saw that.
What else did you see? 16 Hours. Okay. You still got about six more movies to talk about.
Yeah. So then we saw they had a special 70th anniversary of The King and I with Yul Brynner and Deborah Kopp and Rita Moreno. And the special guest for that film was Rita Moreno.
Oh, neat.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and she also did a book signing. She has a book out. And she did a book signing in the lobby of the Roosevelt Hotel across the street. Before the film, she did a book signing, which I also went to. And I got to meet her. And she's lovely, very lovely. A lot of good, juicy stories in her book, let me tell you. She famously dated Marlon Brando. She, not so famously, because I didn't know this, she got pregnant by Marlon Brando, who also had a bunch of kids by a bunch of other different women at the same time. But when she got pregnant, apparently he forced her to have an abortion, and which almost made her commit suicide.
Oh, lovely.
So, yeah, there's a whole lot of drama going on there. But she came out of that dark period, and she became who she is, and I just love her.
She looks great. TCM sent us a bunch of, stills, publicity. She looks fantastic. She looks, everything. She just looks so beautiful.
She's one good-looking EGOT.
She is.
She's 84 years old. And she's running around like she's 50. She's amazing.
And what else did you see?
Okay, so then I saw that. And, a lot of it, too, is, there's the movies, but then a lot of it, the film festival people. The festival has gotten bigger and bigger over the last couple of years. There are so many people now. So now you really have to plan your day. You have to see what movies are playing where, when you have to go get in line, because what they do is you get in line and they give you a number. And then they tell you, okay, you can go do what you want, but just be back in time and get lined up with your numbers again.
Jim has a question really quick.
There's time for coffee, there's time for snack and all that. So then we came back, and then last thing I saw was Rocky.
There you go.
One of my favorite movies ever, ever, ever. And it was the 40th anniversary screening of Rocky. And it's just amazing that movie is that 40 years later, not only are we still talking about that movie and franchise, but another movie had just come out last year in which Sylvester Stallone finally got nominated for an Oscar for his performance as Rocky Balboa. Yeah.
Right.
And at this screening, we had a wonderful talk with Talia Shire, who was there for the 40th anniversary screening. And she actually said that she hadn't actually seen the movie, Rocky, in probably 20 years. Hmm. She doesn't sit around watching it. I just assume people make movies, they sit around watching them all the time. I would. She said she hadn't sat and watched the movie start to finish in about 20 years, so she was going to stay for the screening and watch it with all of us. That just never disappoints, that movie, ever. No matter how many times you see it.
Okay, Melissa?
Do you have a question, Jim?
Yes, I do. I believe it was at this event that they were going to have a new restored version of Horse Feathers, the Marx Brothers classic. Was that true?
They did. That just was up against something else, so it's hard to pick which ones to see, but yes, they did have a screening of Horse Feathers.
Yeah, because I heard that there's been a scene that's been mangled over the years that they finally found the footage of, so I'm really interested in seeing that. Yeah,
that was one of the ones where the line was around the block for that one. Even the standby people, I don't know if they even got in, but yeah, that was a one that a lot of people were talking about.
Oh, well, it sounds like you had a great weekend and saw some great movies, and thanks a lot for calling in.
Anytime,
it's always great when you do.
Anything that happens out here, I'll bring it to you right away.
All right, thanks a lot. But we've got to wrap this up for today because we've run out of time. Next week we'll be back and I'm sure we'll talk a lot about Captain America: Civil War, and I doubt we'll review any other movies because I don't think any other movies are going to be opening, but that's okay. We'll have plenty to say about that. But for now, I'm Tom Stockman.
Michelle McHugh.
Jim Betts.
And be sure to listen again next week.
Black leather, crush, crash, crash. Black leather. leather, black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling, black leather rock. Black leather, crash, crash, crash. Black leather, kill, kill, kill. I got that feeling. Black leather, rock.
Forward in the battle, there, chaps.